Colonel Hammonds, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much.
Hey, we kind of teed the ball up for the first question because I know a lot of people are familiar with the phrase offshore balancing. And originally it sounds familiar and it does share some concepts, but it really looks at the challenge from a different angle, and that is operational control. What is operational control? What does it share with offshore balancing, and what are its important differences?
Well, offshore balancing is one of four schools of grand strategy that Frank Hoffman discusses, I think, in an article in Orbis. But essentially, this is a grand strategy that proposes basing most of our forces in the United States, essentially withdrawing to the United States, and then counting on allies in the region, much with the concept of Britain used to it, draw to the island and count on island allies on the mainland. That's a grand strategy. I was tasked to come up with a specific military strategy, and that's a different problem. Grand strategy is economic, political, social, all of the various things you do as part of a peacetime and wartime strategy, whereas a military strategy is more how you prepare in peacetime for a potential conflict and then how that applies to deterrence. I probably should have named offshore control differently. I named it that way to stress that I was not part of the school that proposes penetrating Chinese airspace. So I was saying stay offshore to do this. In talks with the senior people in Korea and Japan, they really kind of wished I'd named it defense of the first island chain, because that's essentially what it is. The concept is rather than trying to penetrate Chinese airspace, and defeat them by physically bombing them. I'm not sure how you do that to a continental-sized power. But rather than doing that, we would control the sea inside the first island chain. The first island chain is a chain that leads from Korea across to Japan, down to Taiwan, through the Philippines, Indonesia, and then up to the Straits of Malacca. If you can control that island chain and control access to the East China Sea and South China Sea, essentially you can strangle China economically. And you would do that by denying use of the South China Sea and East China Sea with primarily submarines and mine warfare and a limited amount of aircraft operating out of the first island chain. Then you defend the first island chain, those allies who choose to participate in the defense. If China chooses not to attack a nation, then they're probably obviously very, very reluctant to join a war with China. And you dominate outside the first island chain, and that's where you do most of the intercept of merchant shipping. And you don't try to stop every ship. China's economic advantage today is based on the fact they can produce things very cheaply, and part of that cheap production is cheap shipping, and that comes from post-Panamax ships. There's only 1,500 of those in the world. If you control those 1,500 post-Panamax ships, then China can no longer compete effectively economically. And that's the concept.
Well, one of the aspects of you wrote about this in the National Defense University's Strategic Forum in June, and the Naval Institute Proceedings article as a follow-on to that. Are there differences in your view as you've gone a couple of months between these articles?
I think the one difference would be more emphasis on the fact that this is really about two things. It's about matching ends, ways, and means. As you noted at the beginning of the broadcast, our means are decreasing markedly. Our ends are still to protect the first island chain, so the ways we choose is what's important. Can you achieve the goal of protecting the first island chain, allies, global trade, in a cheaper way than building systems that penetrate Chinese airspace? And my contention is you can. You could execute offshore control with the forces we have today. To do a bombing campaign to penetrate Chinese airspace in a big way would require an enormous investment of new money that we're simply, in my opinion, not going to get.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think all it would take is a quick review of the magazines and realize you have a pretty limited time. You could do something like that. When I look at offshore control, and I think it's you have a soft economic warfare and then economic warfare for a lot more of an edge to it. And when I think of trying to economically strangle or create, strategic level effects from an economic point of view on a continental power, I can think of three recent examples, recent being the last 100 years. Depends on how old you are, how long recent is. You have Germany versus UK, UK versus Germany, in both of the world wars, and the Allies thrown in there were applicable. You also had the USA versus Japan in World War II. And you can look back even a little further to what the Union did to the Confederacy during our Civil War. Those are some hard type versions. You also can look at the soft type of economics, which is what we've been going against Iran for well over the last decade, starting really soft with the three European powers while we were in Iraq and Afghanistan, gotten more teeth recently. Offshore control seems to be something between the soft economic sanctions of Iran and the economic sanctions as part of the larger war that we saw in those previous examples. Where in that spectrum does offshore control lay? And there's some characteristics of it that might be familiar to a historian.
Well, first off, in peacetime, there is no effort at sanction. The fundamental problem we've got is that our future depends upon China doing well. Almost all growth models indicate that global growth depends heavily on China continuing to grow. Now, there are some things changing in global trends in manufacturing and how we do that and some other things that may change that. But for the next decade or two, a lot of the growth will rely very heavily on growth in China and India. So you don't want to do anything that inhibits trade with China. You don't want to contain China. It's not like the Soviet Union where it was an autarkic economy. We didn't trade with each other. We didn't care. We wanted to be separate. So you have the problem of in peacetime, you want to sustain Chinese growth. And then in wartime, the key there is there's no such thing as a decisive war anymore if the other side has thermonuclear weapons. And this is one of the things that worries me most. People who push, there is no strategy based on air-sea battle. That's been stated pretty clearly. But people who push futuristic weapons talk about decisive weapons, decisive combat. We haven't had decisive combat since 1945, unless you want to count Grenada. So if you shift your mental model from looking for decisive combat to some way to bring an end to the conflict with the least damage to both sides possible, and that's a somewhat different concept from modern war, but I think is necessary with thermonuclear armed weapons. You know, with both sides having thermonukes. So I think that's one of the critical differences between the previous blockade concept and this. In common with the previous blockade efforts in wartime, you have to understand it's going to be a long conflict. Anybody who states that there can be a short conflict with China based on our bombing them clearly does not understand warfare in the last 200 years. There haven't been short wars other than Bismarck's wars of German unification and the Japanese wars against a collapsing Chinese empire and a collapsing Russian empire. There haven't been short wars. So get over that. Understand it's going to be a long fight. That's a huge advantage to offshore control because if you look at a global map, China absolutely needs the seas inside the first island chain. They must have them for economic growth or even economic stability. We don't need them. They're nice to have for us. We can shut off those seas. What we lose is the trade with China. Now, first off, that's something else to understand. Any war with China is going to devastate the global economy. An historical example of that, in fact, is the First World War. Germany, Britain, France are all very closely integrated economically. And once they go to war, they crash the world economy badly for about a year. One thing, though, is you'll note that Germany doesn't really recover because she has no one she can trade with, whereas Britain and France can rebuild their networks and trade around the world. They have trouble paying for the war, and that's where they get in trouble. Similarly, the rest of the world could rebuild trade around the Chinese seas, inside the first island chain. And frankly, there's a lot of places in the world that would be very happy to make what China makes if China can't make it. So it'll take a year or so to redirect, probably longer than a year, but slowly our economy recovers. The Chinese leadership will have to see this, and they'll have to decide if they want to continue this conflict, knowing that the longer they are out of the global economy, the harder it will be to get back in. And of course, the fundamental issue for the Chinese is survival of the Communist Chinese Party. which I think is also should be one of our objectives. We don't necessarily want that to collapse, because what happens in the vacuum in China? So part of this is not to put the Chinese Communist Party in a zone where they have to keep fighting, because they lose too much face if they don't. And again, in both papers, I mentioned the theory of victory, and you have to have a theory of victory and strategy. This one is that the Communist Chinese see they cannot win and decide to save face and declare victory. Now, they've done this previously in the war with us in Korea, in the River War with the Russians or the Soviets, in their war with Vietnam, and in the war with India, although in the war with India they were winning.
I think one of the questions that has been asked in the chat room, and I want to get clarification, because you mentioned it in your articles, but you don't view this war as imminent. You view this as a very undesirable outcome of world affairs. And what you're proposing, though, is if it did happen, that we have a strategy instead of what you view as in the air sea battle as tactics. Am I correct?
Yeah, essentially, air sea battle is a tactical concept. If you tie it all together, you could elevate it to an operational concept, but it's never been expressed as a strategy. I have challenged proponents to express it as a strategy. No one has done so. A strategy has to give you the assumptions, make ends, ways, and means coherence. In other words, can you achieve what you want with the means you have? Can you figure out a way to do that? And finally, a theory of victory. They don't do any of those things. So a brilliant operational concept, Blitzkrieg was one. It was brilliant against France. It was a disaster against the Soviet Union because there was no strategic concept behind it. It was merely an operational concept. And that's where we are with air sea battle, although it's, I think, now been demoted to just a coordinating office in the normal literature. But anybody who's thinking about penetrating Chinese airspace had better think through what their theory of victory is. The other thing, the most critical part of this approach is it's supposed to be deterrent. And deterrence is based on, the best deterrence is based on, a potential enemy looks at your strategy and says, to defeat that will cost me more than I'm willing to spend. And of course, the key is, because of China's position in global trade, in order to protect her trade, she would have to build a global sea control navy. You've got a fairly sophisticated audience, but for those who aren't familiar with maritime affairs, a sea denial navy is like what the Germans had, submarines, mines, etc. Those are cheaper, easier to build. A sea control navy is one that can escort shipping around the world in such a way to prevent it from being intercepted and maintain its trade. If China wants to achieve that, and that's what she would need to defeat offshore control, she would have to spend trillions of dollars, and it would take a couple of decades. And, of course, a couple of decades from now, China's situation is dramatically different, as is the rest of the planet's. What we're trying to do, what I'm pushing is, the problem I have with air-sea battle is it's eminently defeatable. We state categorically it relies on space and cyber, and yet we know we can't defend space, and we're not sure we can defend cyber. So you build a strategy based on two weaknesses they can attack, and that might convince them that, yes, we can make a success of this if we go after their space and cyber.
There's a French lieutenant who wrote about a century ago that I know Wayne Hughes is a big fan of, and paraphrasing a bit here, he was lamenting towards his own country at the time, saying, if we can't have a fleet to match our strategy, can we at least talk about having a strategy to match our fleet? And I think one reason why the discussion you bring up about offshore control, Lieutenant Ambrose Baldry is his name, is it accepts in the very beginning the budgetary challenge that we're going to. In theory, you can talk about you have a strategy that tells you what type of force you have, and you find the economic power to create that force, but you can be in circumstances where the economic limitations and budgetary limitations are going to tell you what type of force you can have, and then you better make sure that your force can answer what your strategy is promising. And along those lines, when you look at what we can potentially buy with what funds that we have, either that's in production or near in production right now, for a force that is both useful in peace for both presence and deterrence, or if deterrence fails, you have to go to war, What do we have out there that really gives us the most flexibility in both peace and war inside the economic construct we're probably looking at for the next couple of decades?
That's absolutely one of the key questions. In fact, while I don't believe we can solve the cyber and space challenges that would make air-sea battle viable, let's say we could. Well, then it's going to be very expensive. It will be escalatory because when you play a game against an opponent with space and cyber involved, very often both sides go to war early because there's no way to defend space or cyber. So if you move first, you get a big advantage. You don't want any strategy that gives an advantage to moving first. With a nuclear-armed enemy, you want to slow down. But as far as affordable, we've got a number of problems. We're still spending more than the next 12 or 16 nations in the world, and most of those are our allies on defense. But some things have happened since 2001. One, we're paying twice as much per service person as we were in 2001 because of the increased pay, increased benefits, increased educational benefits, downrange medical costs, et cetera. We're paying at least twice as much. Now, that's not going down quickly. So even if your budget comes down to 2001 levels, you're paying twice as much for the personnel. The second thing that's happened is we apparently have lost the ability to build ships and planes at a reasonable price. The F-35 promised at $60 to $70 million. I think the last one rolled off the line at $161 million. With full knowledge, it'll cost $20 million more to repair it. And oh, by the way, that's to repair the things we've discovered in the first 30% of flight testing and first 8% of integration testing. We know the primary helmet, which is the thing that's going to give the 35 pilot the great situational awareness, does not work. The backup helmet does not work. The logistics system, which is really more than a logistics system, it's also a maintenance planning system, a training system, a mission planning system, does not work. And this is not critics of the program saying this. This is the Pentagon's program manager saying this. So we've got an incredibly expensive airplane that probably won't work, or it doesn't now, and will cost a great deal more to fix. The new carrier is going to come in at least twice as much as the last carrier. I don't see any way it gives us twice as much capability, even if we finally get the F-35 to work, so the airplanes will cost 3 to 4 times as much as the F-18 fleet. So it's going to be a very expensive carrier. The LCS is extraordinarily expensive and delivers essentially zero capability. The Danes and Dutch have both produced frigates that are vastly superior for less money than the LCS. And when they're building better ships for less money, the mighty Danish Navy is out shooting you at sea, then you've got some serious problems. So this squeeze is coming down. Our weapons are much more expensive and don't work or don't give us much capability for the increased expense. Our budgets are coming down and manpower costs are increasing. There's an inevitable squeeze. We're not going to be able to buy whatever fantasy fleet you need to do to penetrate China. And not just fleet, but also Air Force.
Well, how closely tied is your vision of where this should go with Captain Hughes' vision of a bifurcated fleet, a smaller inshore capable fleet, and then the blue water fleet that's highly capable for blue water stuff?
Yeah, I will defer to him on expertise on shipbuilding. And I was a Marine infantryman. I did a couple of sea tours, but nowhere near to have the expertise on what a surface fight in the modern Navy looks like. So I'll defer to him. I've read his paper. I like some of the ideas. The LCS is clearly not the answer. But something along that line, which would be more capable ships, and if we look at a defense of the first island chain fleet, then that would be something we would build toward, with still needing the Blue Water Navy to do most of the other presence missions that we do globally. But we can also think about it, because the good news is one of the few programs we have that works really well is the Virginia-class nuclear boat program. They're coming in under budget and ahead of schedule. Now, that's a frickin' miracle for the Pentagon. In fact, we could buy, for the price of one carrier and its air wing, we could buy between 8 and 9 Virginia boats, man them, and have several thousand sailors left over. So this is part of the investment decision discussion you were talking about earlier. Personally, for the future, I'd rather have 9 Virginia-class boats manned and ready than one carrier. That means cutting back on the total number of carriers Then the question is, do we have to have a carrier forward deployed all the time? Manages crisis, it's always called forward in a crisis, but we need a little more serious study on the cost benefit of how much that buys us.
Well, I know submarines play one of the central roles in some of the things you would want to do with offshore control. And you mentioned near the intro that if things did go, you know, kinetic, one of the ways you could do what you want to accomplish here is offensive mining. Offensive mining, something that the U.S. Navy hasn't done, gee whiz, since Haiphong Harbor.
Right.
Now, the lowest risk way to do offensive mining would be by submarines. Are there other assets besides submarines that you see could be useful for offshore control and offensive mining scenario? I'm thinking of some of the larger aircraft, or is that on the risk-reward timeline for what you're looking at, probably not what you want to do?
Again, that would need more study, but I would think cheap drone aircraft might be a possibility, as might some type of a cruise missile delivery system. One of the things that really concerns me about these really expensive, very fragile systems is Arkela's concept of swarms is about to really come true for several hundred miles out. You've seen that they're printing drones with desktop printers now, right? Are you familiar with the desktop manufacturing concept?
Yeah, I think as that technology is developed, that's going to create all sorts of interesting challenges.
Yeah, so you can literally print these drones. You put on a cheap navigation chip, which out of any cell phone, you got a GPS chip and you tell it where to go, and then some kind of cheap visual recognition chip. And, you know, these are coming all over with cameras everywhere with visual recognition. And what you've got is a suicide bomber. You add that to nano explosives, which we're seeing 7 to 10 times the explosive power of C4. So you lift a couple pounds of this, and it's the same as a 20-pound shot. You fly that into critical aspects of high-value systems, and you can damage them, at least get a mission kill. If not, you can't sink them, but you can get a mission kill. Now, you add to that the fact that this kind of a printed drone will have almost no metal in it and a very small engine, so almost no thermal signature, and you begin to wonder, how do I engage this thing? How do I see it first? And then how do I engage it? Particularly if there's hundreds of them coming at me at the same time. So you can see that this begins to, as you begin to look out the lifetime of a carrier, and we're talking 50 years, the Enterprise completed her 50th year and was decommissioned, I think, or just shy of 50 years. What's going to be there in terms of this kind of small, lethal, essentially autonomous system?
Eagle One?
No, I mean, that gives you an idea of what's coming. You can see that the technological change is coming. We are really on the cusp of some massive changes as nanotechnology changes, material science, explosive power, energy and fuel, at the same time that additive manufacturing makes things much, much cheaper. You don't have to design a thing yourself. You'll be able to pull a design of a cheap drone off the web. The gentleman who was doing drones for the U.S. government as a hobby built one that flew autonomously from Nova Scotia to Scotland a couple years ago. But once he's done that, then it's just a matter of time before everybody's doing that kind of as a hobby thing. So that gives you something to think about.
You go on. You're still on board.
No, I'm ready for any other questions.
Oh, sure. No, it's my co-host.
Oh, okay.
Eagle One, are you back? Oh, well, yeah. I'll keep running off then as he tries to recover. The modern technology is always fun. Well, when I look at some of the concepts of offshore control, you look, if you're thinking about a large land power that has, for whatever reason, decided to move to a close island chain, decision is made to oppose that move forward with no intention of going ashore onto the continent, making sure you achieve some limited aims. I see a lot of overlap without the there was no economic campaign against them, but especially with the anti-access, anti-denial issue, there's a lot of overlap with what happened with the Falkland Islands War in the early 1980s. When you look at offshore control from an operational or even a tactical point of view, are there some lessons that come out of the Falkland Islands War that might want to inform how you think about offshore control, especially if you have to do something inside one of those island chains?
Well, I think to a certain degree. Now, one of the things, though, to keep in mind is that part of this concept is to talk to our allies about reversing A2AD. China's not the only person that can use all these new technologies. If Japan does all the way down through their southern island chains, down almost to Taiwan, if Taiwan invests more heavily in defending itself and essentially creating a bristly hedgehog, they've written about that. There's no indications via purchasers or anything else, at least in the unclassified realm, that they're doing that. The Philippines is obviously fairly weak in this area. Indonesia is a rapidly growing power, which can expend money in this. So, again, offshore control, if you use these nations use A2AD, they gain the geographic advantage that the Chinese have to fly out to them, have to send fewer and fewer highly capable assets farther and farther into allied defenses. And they get the advantage of doing cheap systems against expensive systems. So that would be a concept. Rather than waiting like the Falklands, the islands are seized, and now you've got to take them back so you create a maritime exclusion zone, you won't be able to do that. If they were to seize them, it would be very, very difficult. Now, this is where Taiwan is a huge challenge. We have to admit today that we cannot defend Taiwan. If China unleashes thousands and thousands of guided missiles and rockets, then, in fact, Taiwan is going to take a beating. But with the proper investment in A2AD, they could prevent the Chinese forces from landing and seizing Taiwan. And then it's a matter of holding on until we can develop some kind of a way to fight in enough to provide the supplies to keep them in the game. The good news is that any Chinese attack on Taiwan massively damages the Chinese economy. But, of course, the global economy goes down when this happens, too. So, again, one of the problems is I think this is an extremely unlikely conflict. You really have to work to come up with a scenario where China and the United States think this is a good idea. On the other hand, in 1910, numerous authors were writing that it is impossible to have war in Europe because the economies are too intertwined. No one will be dumb enough to make that decision. Now, in my opinion, one of the things that made that decision is that the Germans were convinced they could win a short campaign. Maybe not convinced, but they thought their only hope was a short campaign. They could make it work. And everybody at the start of the war thought it would be a short war. You know, we'll be home by Christmas. We can sustain the economic damage for the 3 or 4 months it takes to wrap this thing up. I doubt that anybody in 1914, if they'd said 4 years of war destroys you economically, let's go, would have thought that was a good idea. That, of course, is part of the thought process of offshore control. You present the Chinese with the very prospect of a very long, economically crippling war, and then they've got to decide if they think that's worth it.
Well, as you see things, is China overplaying its hand in the South China Sea now, and should we be doing more to help countries like the Philippines and Singapore take a look at their defenses?
I'm not a China expert or an Asia expert, but it certainly seems they're overplaying, and they've gotten a response. I mean, Japan has moved significantly rightward since the dust up over the islands. The Philippines, too, are now actually talking to us about sharing bases. So, yeah, we're already doing those things. I mean, we've already got a mutual defense treaty with Japan. The key is going to be going out and talking to them with a military strategy that we can actually execute. The problem, another problem with air sea battle concept, if you, and again, there's no strategy based on air sea battle, but if you try to develop one, you run immediately into the problem of the programs are very highly classified, we won't tell the Allies what we're doing. In fact, we won't tell most American officers what we're doing. So the question then becomes, how do I convince an ally that I've got a plan that will work, but I won't tell him what the plan is? And I won't exercise elements of the plan with him, because then I would reveal my capabilities to the Chinese. But with offshore control, part of the point is if they take down your space in cyber, you rebuild a communication network not relying on space and using cyber based in tethered balloons or longer endurance drones. They're operating well outside the first island chain. And you demonstrate that with just, if necessary, HF radio and surface search radar, you can cut off their trade. If you demonstrate that to them and demonstrate it to the allies and exercise with them regularly, that's much more convincing. The second big issue is if you do anything that strikes into China and you go to an ally and say, look, we want to have exercises with you, the Chinese will protest that you're training to strike mainland China. And that will be a hard sell for most First Island Chain nations to say, yes, we're consciously preparing to strike into China. But if you go to them with a plan that shows their bases only used for defensive purposes, then it is much, much less likely that you'll have trouble convincing the populations that they're willing to do this. And I think that's another major advantage that, frankly, there hasn't been an answer from yet from any proponent of striking into China.
I know there were good reasons to do it for a time, but I always thought it was maybe a mistake when we took our Marine Corps debts off of a lot of our warships to use them elsewhere. And we've predominantly been talking about Navy-related issues and Navy strategy here. But you brought up some use for Marines and also U.S. Army inside of this offshore control concept. What role would they play?
Well, obviously, Army air defense and missile defense would be very important because they would be part of the defense of the First Island Chain. Army logistics as theater support logistics would be there, but it's mostly going to come by sea. The Marine Corps, Marine aviation would be very important to this. Marine amphibious capabilities, if the Chinese lash out and seize a small island, that gives them an advantage and a place to start building base facilities to try to break the blockade, then it might be necessary to go back and take those back. But I think probably the Marine Corps' biggest role is in peacetime, you can train with another force and nobody thinks the Marines are here to stay. They show up on our ships, they exercise for a couple of weeks, and then they go away. And that could be important. The piece that I think you could sell to First Island Chains is Army missile defense batteries, because there's no way these guys can attack China. There's no way they're aggressive. They can't get out of anybody's way. They're there to defend you, and that's all they do. So I think that would be the Army and Marine Corps' role. It doesn't sound like a major role here, but also keep in mind China is a very unlikely conflict. As is clear in the Middle East, that's probably a higher probability area, and the Army and Marine Corps will have larger roles there. So one of the key things is not to spend all our money getting ready for the highly unlikely war for China and then find ourselves wrong-footed for conflicts elsewhere in the world. Because in the last 60 years or so, we've shown the ability to correctly predict where we'll fight about 0% of the time. We just don't do it. Since World War II, we really haven't said, you know, we'll probably fight here and this is where it's going to unroll.
Yeah. One of the other aspects of your thought that I like was that you state that this offshore control kind of expands the decision time and space we have to take action. Can you kind of go over that a little bit?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most important things. Remember, I said that I think that anything involves space and cyber tends to be escalatory, and that both sides have to move first. Because if you don't, you lose a tremendous amount of advantage. But when you look at the only two wars between nuclear armed powers are the Soviet-Chinese River War, 1969, which actually got pretty large, up to about a corps on each side was involved, multiple divisions on each side. Both sides were very careful not to strike deep into the other side's territory or do anything which might trigger a nuclear response. You look at India and Pakistan in the Kargil War. Pakistan decides to do something bold against India. Now, in the past, they've had massive wars that have killed tens of thousands, captured hundreds of thousands. But this time, Pakistan sneaks a few platoons about 10 kilometers into India and then announces a victory. India doesn't respond by a big demonstration or massive attacks. They kind of pull back from the dangerous border, they move to the north and say, look, this is what we're going to do. And very carefully, very transparently, they move forces in place and then remove the Pakistani presence right back to the line of control. So there's no possibility of escalation. The only case we can find of really big powers, the U.S. and the USSR confronting themselves over Cuba. And if you look at it, both sides were very careful to move slowly, deliberately, and announce what they were doing carefully so that the negotiators could keep working behind the scenes. And, of course, you managed to make the deal of you'll take your missiles out of Cuba, we'll take our missiles out of Turkey kind of deal. So both sides got something. That may be the most important element, buying time to back the crisis down so you don't break into open conflict. Because the huge danger of open conflict, as Clausewitz noted, is that once war starts, in the Trinity, passion takes over, and the danger is passion drives out reason.
China has a history, and you brought up the River War. We also had our own experience with the Chinese in Korea and the Vietnamese-Chinese border conflict a few decades ago as well. The Chinese have a history of having a high threshold of being able to take casualties. But that was a different China. One thing that characterizes China today, the demographics, is very different than what it used to be. And there's a lot of talk in economic circles about how China will get old before it gets rich. And is there something about the changing of the Chinese demographics and their quasi-capitalistic system that maybe would change how we are thinking the Chinese might react to certain things as opposed to what the Chinese mindset was as little as 15 years ago?
Well, again, I think this is all part of the reason the people who are running around warning about China wanting to be a hegemon and take over misunderstand Chinese history and the Chinese future. China has never been a particularly aggressive power. They've got their natural boundaries they pushed out to, and they pretty much stayed in there. They pushed into Vietnam. It took about 1,000 years for the Vietnamese to get rid of them, but they're out. And then the 79 war, which to make a point, when the point was over, they left. They didn't do well. And their future is a number of things. The demographic problem that you've mentioned, they will, in fact, get old before they get rich. There's no way around that. We already know how many Chinese they are. We already know how fast they're aging. And even if they stay at the phenomenal growth rate they have now, they won't get there. But they're also facing the normal slowdown in the development curve. When you get somewhere between $2,000 and $4,000 of average annual income, the growth starts to taper off. And we're seeing that in China as they're dropping from 9% to 7.5%. That would be great growth in a mature economy, but not enough in a Chinese economy. At the same time, as they're facing their aging problem, they're facing great environmental problems, not the least of which is going to be enormous water shortages in the North China Plain. So all of those things come together to create a China which is not growing nearly as rapidly as it has in the past, nor that is nearly as much interested in reaching out. In fact, again, this year, for all the growth in Chinese's defense budget, the growth of their internal defense was more. The percentage growth was more, and they're already spending more on internal security than they are on defense. So it's hard for me to visualize this ultimately aggressive striking out China because they're just not in position to do that.
One of the things that interested me in your article is it seemed to be kind of the opposite of it's like judo. You know, if your enemy's weak, you want to be strong. But if your enemy's strong, you want to find a way to get inside their power. So in this case, China has devoted a lot of time to defeating our aircraft carriers, it looks like. I mean, they've got various systems set up to do that. But I liked the jiu-jitsu you applied to them, where if this is the way we went, that this eliminates a lot of that a lot of the threat of those systems. They would have to come up with a whole new structure to counter.
Yeah, we essentially negate China's massive investment in A2AD. But I think just as important, it goes to the age-old concept of the defense is stronger, And if you can fall back further and make them reach out, then if they're fighting at the limit of their range, they're at a disadvantage. I mean, this is consistent in whether it's the Germans attacking Britain or U.S. and British forces attacking Germany. When you're at the extreme range of your forces, you're at a disadvantage. And then there are fewer and fewer of your assets that can reach out that far. You know, every plane China has can fight over China. Only a certain percentage can get as far as Japan. And in order to do that, they've got to set up the command and control and the refueling assets and all those sorts of things that are necessary. It also eliminates some of China's investment. China's clearly been investing in trying to take down our AWACS and our refuelers with very long-range air-to-air missiles. Again, it's a very slow-moving target. It's not a good maneuver. But if you can knock those down, you push our fighters back. We can reverse that on them. And if they want to bring their tankers out to refuel their fighters, then we go after their tankers, a much softer target than going after their fighters.
And obviously, going over to Westpac for anything that we would do, we would have to rely on or at least closely coordinate with our allies over there. And when you look at our traditional allies, we'll just go north to south, Japan, South Korea, Philippines. You can throw in Singapore if you like, then Australia, New Zealand, even further south. And even some that aren't traditional allies but are very much warming towards us, like Vietnam. How do those nations, perhaps, would they look at the concept of offshore control different than they would air-sea battle concept? Which ones might like that concept more, or is there something about offshore control that might concern some of those other nations that if we were going this direction, we would make sure we want to address with them?
Like I said, my problem in naming it offshore control confused in their mind with offshore balancing, which does worry them because that's the U.S. withdrawing to its continental boundaries. So that worries them. When I explain to them that it's really defense of the first island chain, they like that much better than attacking into China. And again, for two reasons. First off, almost every nation out there, their largest trading partner is now China. So they turn to China for economic growth. They turn to the U.S. for security. So we've got to, we need that, we need it to continue, but if we demand that they support our efforts to strike into China, it's really a tough sell for a democratic nation to say it's a good idea to strike into China. It's not a tough sell to say it's a good idea to be prepared to defend yourself against China, particularly since China in the last 2 years has blundered badly in terms of looking aggressive in the South China Sea and acting aggressively. Our traditional allies of Japan has moved much closer over the Senkakus. Korea is still, hey, wait a minute, most of our trade is with China and we're good about that. Stay here to help us for defense against Korea, but we're not really that interested in China. So the offshore control or first island chain defense interests them. The Philippines, frankly, don't have a lot to add other than geography and great bases. Indonesia is a growing economy. As we begin to see them invest in more submarines, that's a very interesting choice because it implies an A2AD strategy. Singapore the same way. Singapore is very careful to say they are not a formal ally of the United States. They will deal with both states equally. Now, interestingly, they built a pier that just happens to be long enough to handle our carriers, but they've also stated categorically that China is welcome to tie up to those piers and use them too. So this is the balance that all of them have to do out there. They've got a balance between China and the U.S. Any demands on the U.S. that they firmly pick a side, and we will help you strike into China, I think is a non-starter. But if the only side we ask them to pick is their own, do you want to defend your state, your nation, then yeah, they can sign up to that.
As we look forward, in addition to the first island chain, which we've talked about, there's a second island chain that the Chinese have addressed previously, too. And should we be looking at and enhancing the defense systems structures on that second island chain, too?
Yeah, we are. I mean, with the movement of more forces to Guam and the studying of hardening Guam, and, of course, still Japan as the first island chain, that becomes important. We're looking at spreading our bases around, having spaces rather than bases, places we can go to in time of war that are not pre-groomed, but at least are good enough to operate from. So that's a possibility. Also, because of where the choke points are through the Indonesian and around Australia, that's the distance where this is defended primarily. So that's clearly an option for us, the second island chain. One of the issues that I should have talked about is this whole problem with whether it's offensive or defensive offshore control.